One of the advances that we see in the world in this area of technology is the idea of drones, right? And what drones do? I mean, it's really something when we consider the drone. I mean, they deliver packages, and kids use them as toys, and we see them hovering over stadiums during sporting events, and they really come to the forefront in warfare. I was reading recently about the battle against terrorism, and this was a long time ago, a while ago, and our presidents and trying to get some of these leaders of Al-Qaeda and various terrorist groups. And the book that I was reading discussed how they would send in a drone into the mountains of Afghanistan and some of these places in the Middle East. And a person over here in the United States, sitting in an office here in the United States, was guiding this drone, right, across the ocean and in the mountains. And this drone would seek out the enemy and blow up a compound or blow up a car to get rid of these heads of terror groups. And, of course, these cost about up to $40 million for something like this. Wars of the future, some experts say, will be all about the drones and less about humans. We're familiar with artificial intelligence, AI, and it's in the news a lot these days. People are talking about it. And defense experts are working on something called the swarm. You know, you have a swarm of bees, a swarm of birds. We've all seen them when they migrate, or we see them in the sky. And this weapon would be like that swarm of insects and birds. It would be a large group of small drones, like the size of a starling. And each one thinks for itself and shares information with the other drones. And they are able to communicate. They are able to take in everything around them, the weather, the environment. If there is any threat anywhere, they are able to bring this information in from the environment and not only perceive it, but they pass it between themselves. How do you fight something like that? Wow. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit today about a war that happened long before drones. But people were in a very bad place. It was around the 700 BCs with a king named Hezekiah. He was a king of Judah. He was one of the good ones. And Hezekiah is in the land of Judah, right? Southern kingdom. And what's happening is a guy named Sennacherib. He's an Assyrian king, and he is pretty powerful. He's pretty mean, right? Sennacherib is, his armies are something, you know, and they are wiping out all of the neighbors and taking their stuff and their land and their peoples and creating havoc. Sennacherib sends a letter to Hezekiah and he says, look, all these people out there have their gods and they know I'm coming and they all pray to their gods, and you know what? None of their gods have delivered them. I've beat them all. So I'm sending you this letter. I know you people in Judah serve God. I know you believe in God. I know you think your God's better, the only God. But none of the other gods have saved their people. Your God's not going to save his people. And so I'm going to give you the opportunity here to surrender. God sends, well, first of all, Hezekiah sits down like any normal person would do. He sits down with his cabinet. He sits down with his leaders. And back in those days, as today, You have advisors. You have very wise people. You have very smart people. You have strategists in war. And so Hezekiah goes to these people first, right? So we need help. We need a plan. We got to do something. What are we going to do? And they say, here's what we got to do. We have to make an alliance with our neighbors. We have to go to Egypt, and we have to get in charge with the people in Egypt and make an alliance, and they will help us. They will deliver us. God sends Isaiah, the prophet, to Hezekiah with a message. And the message is essentially this: you are not going to escape this guy with any of your political cunning or any of your trickery or your human wisdom or knowledge. God tells Hezekiah through Isaiah, I am going to destroy this guy, Sennacherib. I am going to do it, not you, and you can't do it. You're unable. Well, gee, how's that going to happen, right? I mean, how's he going? This is a big army. How's God going to do that? No drones, that's for sure. No automatic weapons, nothing like that. Well, here's what happened, and you can read about it in 2 Kings chapter 19. That night, as the Assyrian army is gathered around and all around, they've surrounded the land of Judah. They're everywhere. That night, one angel, went out and slayed 185,000 of the Assyrians. The next morning, when they get up and they look outside, nothing but bodies of the Assyrians everywhere. Well, Sennacherib went home. Okay? He got on his horse, he got in his chariot, and he just went home. And the Bible tells us that not long after that, his sons actually put him to death. Now, why this story? What does this story have to do with today and today's readings? Well, this is exactly the story that Paul is quoting. This is exactly what Paul is saying to the Corinthians. This is what's in his mind. Let me read the whole quote to you. And the Lord said, this is from Isaiah 29, what Paul is quoting in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Because this people draw near with their mouth and honor me with their lips, while their hearts are far from me, and the fear of me is a commandment taught by men. Therefore, behold, I will again do wonderful things with this people, with wonder upon wonder, and the wisdom of their wise shall perish, the discernment of their discerning shall be hidden. That was God's message to Hezekiah. Paul has this story in his mind, okay, on his heart, and he quotes Isaiah 29:13, and he says, you guys remember what happened back there in 700 BC? Do you remember what it was like going to another source to solve your problems, to figure things out, to get an understanding, to know what's going on and how things work? You see, the context in Corinth is, it's not about war. It's not about a foreign enemy coming in or an attack like it was in Hezekiah's time, but it is about a war, but just not one with soldiers and weapons. It's about a war of thoughts, a war of a way of life, a war of wisdom, a war where you have a group of people looking at money and power and wisdom to face their problems, to face life. And all of a sudden, factions have occurred and they're fighting with each other. People are divided over their politics even. Could you imagine that? And Paul has to write to these people. In the city of Corinth, some believe that there were as many as 50 different philosophies available. The Greeks loved philosophy, didn't they? I mean, even today, You know, when we think of philosophy and people study philosophy, boy, you think, you know, you think of the Greeks, Plato and Aristotle, and, you know, those folks, they had it, didn't they? Interesting word, you know, it's really made up of two words, phileo and sophia. Phileo is love, sophia is wisdom. Philosophy means the love of wisdom. The love of wisdom. And a definition of it would take a long time, but I just looked up one educational institution, and their definition of it seemed pretty simple. I'm sure we could, you know, go deeper, but they said it's an activity. Philosophy is an activity of attempting to understand the world and all of its aspects. And they declare there are four pillars of philosophy: theoretical, practical, there's logic, and history. And on these four pillars and studying these four areas, we determine man's meaning and destiny. Now, there's a whole lot more that can be said, but that, for me, that just is a nice, succinct definition. The Greeks were great philosophers. The Greeks loved it. And their society was divided into groups. And whoever was great with this rhetoric, you know, speaking, if you could get up and defend your beliefs about the world and where it came from and where we're going, and you could argue the other people there with your wisdom, with your speech and your silver tongue, and you could, you know, you were a hero in Greece, like today's actors and sports and athletes. So the Greeks really loved this. But in the city of Corinth, it was wisdom, it was money, and it was power. Paul says of the Jews, now you are a different group of people in Corinth. You are about power, because the Jews were always oppressed. Somebody's always swooping in and taking over their country, right? Throughout history, continually happens. They came to Jesus and they said, okay, you say you're God, or you say, show us something, you know, do something, give us a sign, show us a power, prove it, right? Prove it. People are like that today. Jesus said an evil and uncorrupt generation looks for a sign. He wouldn't give them a sign. But they were looking for power, looking for wisdom. And they had divided amongst themselves into these various groups. And along comes Paul with his message, which is very, very different. And into all of these groups that we have, and all of these factions in the church in Corinth, Paul, using two Greek present participles, okay, he divides all of mankind into two groups. Two groups, he says, and they're present. You know, it's going on right now, he says. They're present participles. There are people. There are those who are perishing, and there are those who are being saved. And he just says, forget everything else. That's the two ways to live. That's the two ways to understand life. The meaning of life. Why we're here, where we're going, what's here, where it all came from, what it's all about, what's right, what's wrong. There's only two ways to figure that out, says Paul. And you people are like you're like Hezekiah. You're going, you want for advice, for help, for rescue, to find answers. You're going to Egypt. It's only two groups, and one group accepts it, and one rejects it. And we'll finish this next week, because we are in chapter 2 next week. But Paul has a unique way of saying, he says, here's the thing. I know you're looking for something really cool. I know you're looking for something really smart. I know you're looking for a sign or some power or a miracle or something big to happen. But Paul says, our kerygma, which is our preaching, but he's not talking about preaching like what I'm doing. He's talking about a kerygma is it's a succinct body of truth. It's a belief, right? And he's saying the thing about where the power is, where the wisdom is, where you go for help, okay, it sounds ridiculous. It sounds ridiculous that one angel could go out and defeat an Assyrian army. And he says, it's the same thing with God. His way, his work, his way of understanding is a scandalon. Stumbling block. Scandalon. Scandalous is where we get the word. It's a scandalon. To those who don't see it, it's scandalous. To those who don't see it, it's folly. That's the Greek word Maria. That's where we get our word moron, right? Paul is using some very, very good language here, isn't he? It's a scandal. We're morons, is what he's saying. People who believe God's rescue plan and God's philosophy and God's wisdom are morons to the unbelieving. Now, to be clear, we're not against anti-intellectualism here. We're not against learning. We're not against questioning. We're not against debating and theological discussion. All those things are very important in the Bible, to Paul, and certainly to us. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a message with power and hope and wisdom of a way to live, a way to understand life, a way to know who you are and where you're going and what you have to do, a way to know what's right and wrong that is absolutely, looks ridiculous. It looks ridiculous. I just want to close with a story by Calvin Miller that kind of describes that in the 1960s, he talks about going to a movie, and it was one of those epic biblical movies. I'm not sure what one it was, but it was a drama on the screen in color, and the story of Jesus. And he describes being in that movie theater, and Jesus is on the cross, and the sky all around him is black and dark. And all of a sudden, the blood begins to flow in little rivulets from his wounds and his hands. And the camera, of course, zooms in. And that blood just flows little by little down the cross. And it goes down to the bottom. And it starts to run into a depression, a form of puddle in the stone. And it starts to fill up. And then the rain comes. And the rain comes in pours. And this little basin at the foot of the cross fills up. And then this crimson tide, this water and blood begins to roar down the hill in a torrent. It's gripping, he said. He's sitting there and he's thinking, that's for the world's salvation. That's for my salvation. And as he's thinking that, the lights go on and it's intermission time. And he says he walked out into the intermission and he says, people are just like, they're eating popcorn, they're laughing, they're joking, they're standing in line, they're smoking, it's like nothing, like nothing at all had happened. And that is how opposing these things are. Hopefully we'll talk more next week. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.